Well, good evening. It is wonderful to be with you again at Smithson Church this evening. I was here on Wednesday night, at the beginning of this sort of grand tour of Inverness that Alistair alluded to. Actually, it hasn't been too much of a hard schedule. On one occasion, I did a week of ministry in Plymouth, and in the run-up to that, I said to the churches who were organising the trip, "Work me as hard as you like." And they had me speak 27 times in 6 days. So this is fairly tame. I will come back to Inverness. But it's great to be with you here, for those of you here in person, and also a hello to all of you watching on the live stream. As you heard, my name is Andy Bannister, and I work for an organization called SOLAS. It's a Christian organization that exists to persuasively communicate the hope and the good news of Jesus, particularly to those outside the four walls of church. And we love helping people think about the big questions of life. And we've been doing that all week here in Dundee, in Inverness, spoken in churches and spoken at hotels and other kind of settings, really helping people see how Jesus offers hope in these kind of crazy times that we're living through. And this evening, as we were sort of setting up tonight, I asked Alistair what he would like me to speak on to you this evening. And he asked me to speak on the topic of war and peace. Now, you'll be glad to know that is not the big book by the Russian writer Leo Tolstoy. That is not tonight's topic. So if you have come this evening as a representative of the Inverness Russian Literature Society, I'm afraid you have misunderstood tonight's message. That is not the theme, but hopefully you'll still enjoy this evening as we explore together this crucial question of what hope Jesus has to offer us in these times that we are living through. And to help us this evening think about that, we're going to take a look at two Bible passages as part of the sermon this evening, one at the sort of start of the message, and then we're going to dig into another one a little bit further in. But the first passage we're going to take a look at as we dive into this whole topic of war and peace, we're going to take a look at Mark's Gospel. And I'm going to read to you from Mark chapter 13, verses 1 through 8. It's going to appear on the PowerPoint behind me, but if you've got a Bible with you, do feel free to open it and follow along as we go. But let me read you this passage from Mark's Gospel, the earliest of the four biographies of Jesus found in the New Testament in the Bible. And Mark reports that as Jesus was leaving the temple, one of his disciples said to him, "Look, teacher, look, what massive stones, what magnificent buildings." "Do you see all these great buildings?" replied Jesus. "Not one stone here will be left standing on another. Every one will be thrown down." As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives opposite the temple, Peter, James, John, and Andrew asked him privately, "So tell us, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign that they are about to be fulfilled?" Jesus said to them, "Watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, claiming, 'I am he,' and they will deceive many. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, do not be alarmed. Such things will happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be earthquakes in various places and famines. These are but the beginnings of the birth pains." Well, there's a lot more that passage goes into, but we'll leave it just there for now. We'll come back to that in just a few moments' time. But to kind of set the scene as we dive into this topic this evening, and I was struck the other day, by how quickly our world has changed. It's changed frighteningly fast in the last few weeks and months and so on. But for the last few weeks, it's changed rapidly, hasn't it? Because for three decades at least, I think most of us had assumed that the Cold War was over, that there was peace in our time, that we were living in this amazing era of peace and prosperity and security. And then, of course, suddenly, Russia invaded Ukraine, and that illusion was utterly shattered to pieces. And it's become painfully obvious in the past few weeks that far from living in this sort of eternal age of permanent peace and security, it does seem to be that maybe, in fact, war is far more the sort of default position of the human condition. In fact, the day that Russia invaded Ukraine, it's one of those days that I think I'll always remember where I was, because I was actually in this part of the country. I was staying not far from here, a little village called Kiltality. Some of you may know that part of the country, just down the road, staying with a friend there. And I had one of my sort of regular bouts of insomnia. I remember waking at 5 a.m., found myself wide awake, unable to get back to sleep. So I foolishly did what you should never do at 5 a.m. in the morning. I turned on my phone and flicked onto the news and found myself much more wide awake with a bit of a shock. And in an instant, I remember lying there in bed, scrolling through sort of article after article after article, flipping from news site to news site until the sun came up, feeling more and more and more depressed as I went. In fact, I read just the other day that there has been a new word coined to describe that phenomena that I was going through there. And maybe some of you have done exactly this thing. There's this new word being coined recently called doom scrolling. In fact, you're laughing. Many of you know exactly what this is. Doom scrolling apparently is this new word that's been coined to describe this tendency that we have developed of sort of lying in a depressed little heap in bed or on the sofa, you know, flicking morosely through bad news story after bad news story after bad news stories. And of course, we live right now in some very difficult times, and it's going to take more than a little bit of black humor to cheer us up. You know, we've had the pandemic, we've had the cost of living crisis, and now we have Putin and Ukraine. And as Alistair said in his introduction, many of us are asking, you know, what is going on? I think many of us had sort of lulled ourselves into thinking that war, at least war in Europe, was a thing of the past. What has happened? What has happened to that world of peace and prosperity that we thought would last forever? Well, of course, that is not a new question. One of the things that's interesting is most of the big questions that we ask are not new questions. They've been asked before. And it's a question that Jesus addressed in that passage in Mark 13 that I read to you just a few minutes ago. So let's return to it. Let's return to Mark chapter 13. And as we do so, I want to think about three things together this evening. Three things I want to think together this evening out of this passage and out of the other passage we're going to look at in a few minutes' time. I want to think together for a few minutes this evening about the failure of humanity. I want us to think together a little bit about the source of hope. And I want us to think about the place of real peace. So I want us to think about the failure of humanity, the source of hope, and the place of real peace. So let's start with the first of those on my little list there. And let's talk about the failure of humanity for a few moments. You see, one of the things I find striking about humanity and human beings is that we fall into this regular trap as humans, no matter what era or age we're living in that we fall into this trap of believing that we can build heaven here on earth. You know, we regularly find ourselves thinking that by our own cleverness, by our own technology, by our own politics or engineering or healthcare, whatever it is, we think we can create utopia. We can create heaven here on earth because we are just so smart. And we see that tendency, we see that trap illustrated here in Mark chapter 13. As Jesus and his disciples are leaving the Jerusalem temple, this wonderfully impressive building, the disciples, who are probably rural Galileans, so they're already a bit goggle-eyed at being there in the big city, they get swept up in the wonder of the moment. They get swept up in how just magnificent everything is. Look, teacher, they say. I mean, look at the building. Jesus, have you seen how magnificent it is? Look at the stones. Look how massive they are. Look how fantastic it is. And that reaction they have there is not a surprise, actually. Archaeologists and historians, you know, will tell you a lot if you read them about Herod's temple, which the second temple, known as Herod's temple, named after Herod the Great, who had overseen its massive expansion, was a truly spectacular building. It was probably one of the largest construction projects of the first century BC. It was simply unbelievably impressive. And in fact, even by the time of Jesus, work had been going on in this thing for decades after decades. It still wasn't finished. Who can imagine great construction projects that never get finished? But that's a discussion for another time. It had the reputation of being one of the wonders of the ancient world. The stones, interesting the disciples mentioned the stones, because the first century Jewish historian Josephus tells us about the stones. He reports that some of the stones of the temple were pure white, and some of them were 37 feet long, 12 feet high, and 18 feet wide. It was probably the largest structure for hundreds of miles around. You could see it for miles away. When the sun shone down, there it was, glinting white in the distance. And many Jews in the first century believed that the temple would last forever. They believed that it was a sign of God's favor and blessing upon Israel. It was a sign of Israel's status as God's chosen people, and absolutely nothing could shake it. But along comes Jesus and staggers their minds, blows their minds by demolishing these utopian dreams that they have of how amazing everything is, by calmly pointing out to them, not one stone will be left standing. Not one stone, Jesus prophesies. And that prophecy actually was fulfilled just 40 years later. Just 40 years later in AD 70, when the Roman armies swept in and destroyed Jerusalem and utterly flattened the temple. But, you know, when Jesus says these words to his disciples, they probably would have found it hard to believe. They'd have thought, how on earth are you insane, Lord? I mean, this is the temple. How could this dream, this amazing thing that we've built, come to nothing? And of course, it's easy to look back with the benefit of hindsight and sort of smile at their foolishness. I mean, how could anyone believe that a mere building would last forever? But so, as I say, throughout history, from then down through the ages to today, human beings continually fall for this belief, this myth, this illusion that we can build utopia, a glorious future, or we can usher in peace and harmony through our own cleverness. And there are many, many examples we might point to in the light of, you know, what's going on in Ukraine right now. One might point, for example, to communism. Think of Soviet Russia at its height, that promised, you know, everything for its citizens, that they would build peace and prosperity and equality. And the result of communist Russia was hundreds of millions of people dead. If it's not political dreams that we can, you know, we can bring peace and prosperity through our clever politics, then it's often we fall into utopian thinking as human beings when it comes to things like science. You know, we think that, well, you know, the ancients, yeah, you can understand them being foolish, but hey, we're here in the 21st century. We have science and technology and progress. We can build a healthy, green, prosperous, peaceful future. But it can be sobering for our age to realize that one of our dreams, science, actually is a much more complicated story. To consider, for example, the story of the illustration of Louis Frederick Pfizer, which I think illustrates the foolishness of scientific utopian dreams. Who was Pfizer? Well, he was one of the greatest chemists of the 20th century. In fact, he was instrumental for developing the first artificial synthesis of vitamin K. That was a discovery, an amazing breakthrough that has probably saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Amazing piece of science. But Pfizer developed something else as well. In 1942, the U.S. Army approached him and his team of fellow scientists at Harvard University, and they asked whether they might help them, the Army, develop a chemical weapon that could burn tracts of jungle and eliminate troops. And so Pfizer and his small team at Harvard University, they invented napalm, a gel that sticks to human bodies when it burns. On the 9th of March, 1945, 1,700 tons of napalm were dropped on Tokyo, burning 100,000 civilians to death, and even more, were killed in Vietnam by napalm. Pfizer's story is a sobering reminder, if ever we needed one, that science, no more than politics or economics or architecture, in the case of the Jerusalem Temple, none of those things can deliver us a peaceful utopian future. Science can harm, as well as heal. It can burn as well as build. And so Jesus is warning about placing our trust in stones and things and the fact those dreams will come tumbling down around our ears. His warning is as relevant today as it was then. But Jesus doesn't stop there. He goes on, doesn't he, in Mark 13, to warn the disciples of what's coming next. He warns them that the head lie wars and rumors of wars. And even today, this carries on. Today it may be Ukraine. I mean, tomorrow it may be Azerbaijan or the next trouble spot in the world. You know, for 2,000 years since Jesus spoke those words, we have seen evidence after evidence after evidence that Jesus was absolutely right. Humanity cannot progress its way to utopia. And wars and rumors of wars are not going away. Humanity's dreams always ultimately end in dust and ashes, be they political dreams, scientific dreams, or whatever. Now, this is all a little bit depressing, or at least sobering. And of course, it begs the question, if this is true, this kind of somewhat bleak picture that I've painted for you this evening, what possible hope is there? That's a good question, isn't it? One of my colleagues at work was recently chatting with a next-door neighbor. He and his wife have become quite good friends with their next-door neighbors. And the next-door neighbors are quite committed atheists, actually. Over the years, my colleague and his wife have tried repeatedly to have conversations about faith with their friends next door, and it's always got shut down. There's always been pushback. No spiritual interest. But the other day, as they were talking over the back fence, the next-door neighbor's wife mentioned, unprovoked, she just mentioned that she was having real trouble sleeping because she was terrified about the prospect of nuclear war. What happens, she said to my colleague and his wife, what happens if Ukraine becomes World War III? She said, ashen-faced, I just can't sleep with worry. And then she looked at my colleague and his wife and she said, oh, but I guess, of course, you're Christians, so you have a hope and you don't worry about something like that. I wish I had the hope that you had. My word, that, I tell you, opened up a conversation. But where can we find hope? Where can we find hope in the world? Where can we find a hope that keeps you going in troubled times? Of course, if you are an atheist, if you believe that we live in a godless universe where the only things that exist are atoms and particles, then I am afraid, and I say this with the greatest compassion I can muster, knowing there might be guests here or guests watching on the live stream who may not have a faith, then with the greatest compassion I can say, if you are an atheist, there is no hope to be found. And don't take my words for it as a Christian. Take the words of one of the most famous atheists of the 20th century, Bertrand Russell, who thought deeply on a lot of these questions around hope and concluded that as an atheist, there was none to be found. Let me read you a very famous paragraph he wrote on this subject. Bertrand Russell wrote, he said, man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end that they were achieving. His origin, his growth, his hopes and his fears, his loves and his beliefs are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms. No fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. All the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system. And the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. Cheerful chap was Bertrand Russell. Interesting his use of the word temple as an illustration there. I wonder if you spotted that in terms of Mark 13. But for all of that cheerfulness or lack thereof, what I appreciate is Bertrand Russell's honesty. He's right if atheism is true. But the good news is, of course, atheism, I don't believe, is true. Because if atheism isn't true, if we don't live in a godless universe, at that point, the words of comfort that Jesus speaks to his disciples in Mark 13 hold true. And what Jesus says to them, he says to them, don't be alarmed. I would love to be a fly on the wall at this scene. He's described what's coming, and the disciples obviously looking a bit upset at this point. And Jesus says, yeah, this is all coming, but don't be alarmed. And notice what he doesn't say. It's very interesting to say, notice what Jesus doesn't say. He doesn't say, oh, actually, don't worry, I was exaggerating, there won't be wars. He doesn't backpedal. He doesn't say there won't be wars or rumours thereof. He doesn't say, you know what, life will all be wonderful, lads, don't worry, it'll all be rainbows and kittens and unicorns. He doesn't say that. He doesn't say life won't be hard and difficult. He doesn't say there might not be suffering. But he does say, and not just here, repeatedly throughout the Gospels, Jesus does say that those who trust him need not fear. They need not be alarmed. They need not worry. Because no matter how crazy the world looks, you know, as a follower of Jesus, that in the end, love wins and evil is not the last word. In fact, there's one of my spiritual heroes, Corrie ten Boom. Some of you may know that name. She lived through World War II and experienced horrific suffering as a follower of Christ. As Corrie ten Boom once famously put it, she said, never be afraid to trust an unknown future to a known God. We may not know what is coming over the next horizon, but we know the character of God who is seen over that horizon and who we follow into that future. And therefore, as Christians, we don't need to be afraid. But outside of the Christian faith, outside of God's love and God's faithfulness and God's providence, outside of the resurrection power of Jesus, I know of no hope for the world. But if Christianity is true, if Jesus' claims about who he is stand up, then yes, I can trust and I can hope despite an unknown future because the character of God is not in question. So we've thought together then about the failure of humanity. We've thought a bit about the source of hope, how there's no hope on atheism, but there is tremendous hope on Christianity and in Jesus. But one last thing I want us to think about in the rest of our time together this evening, and that's I want to think a little bit about that third topic on the list, the place of real peace. You see, one of the reasons I believe that humanity's attempts throughout history to build utopia, to build heaven here on earth, always end in despair or disappointment or disaster is that as humans we repeatedly misdiagnose the problem in the world. And when you get the diagnosis wrong, then you will get the prescription and the solution wrong. Just like in Mark chapter 13, where the Jewish people and the disciples thought that, you know, a beautiful temple, that's what they needed, that would solve all of their problems. And it's similar today, actually. As human beings, we have a huge tendency to get the core diagnosis of a problem wrong. Let me give you an illustration of how we're doing this today in a different setting. You know, take one of the big challenges facing our world today. When you put Ukraine to one side, one of the other huge challenges facing our age are the environmental challenges facing our planet in various shapes and forms, from climate change to plastic in the ocean to pollution. The list goes on. Well, I came across recently an amazing quote on this whole subject, an amazing observation around the environmental challenges facing our planet from one of the world's top climate scientists. His name is Gus Speth. He has no religious faith, as far as I know. He doesn't believe in any, he doesn't follow any religion. He's not an atheist, but he's sort of agnostic. A very senior scientist. He was advisor to the US government during the Obama years on climate issues, and he is one of the top experts on environmental issues in the world today. Listen to his diagnosis of what's gone wrong with the world. As I say, he is not a religious individual, which makes his observations all the more interesting. Gus writes, he says, I used to think that the top environmental problems were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, and climate change. I thought 30 years of good science could address those problems. I was wrong. The top environmental problems are selfishness, greed, and apathy. And to deal with those, we need a cultural and a spiritual transformation. And we scientists don't know how to do that. Interesting. Gus puts his finger in that statement on a much deeper issue, a spiritual issue underlying one of the world's current contemporary problems. And it's the same when it comes to war and peace. Unless we figure out and address the root cause of what causes violence in our world and why humanity struggles to find peace, whether it's between nations or between individuals, no amount of, you know, UN peacekeeping initiatives are going to help. So what is the real cause of the problems when it comes to war and peace? What is the real thing that holds us back from finding peace? Well, the Bible talks a lot about war, and it talks a lot about peace. And in one remarkable passage in the New Testament, it explains the root cause of what has gone wrong with humanity. Let's read together the other passage I wanted us to look at this evening, and that's from Romans chapter 5. Again, we're going to read the first 8 verses and see how this can offer us some help on diagnosing actually what has gone wrong when it comes to peace in our world and in our hearts and with each other. So in Romans 5, Paul writes these words. He says, "Therefore, since we have been justified through faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, through whom we have gained access by faith into this grace in which we now stand. And we boast in the hope of the glory of God. Not only so, but we also glory in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope. And hope does not put us to shame, because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit who has been given to us. You see, at just the right time, while we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person, although for a good person, somebody might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." And in this passage and numerous other places, the Bible puts its finger on the issue, on the fact, on the reality that the most serious conflict in history, both in the past and also in our contemporary society today, is not conflict between Russia and Ukraine, nor any other human conflict, but the fact that humanity is at war with God. That is the basic underlying root cause behind everything else that has gone wrong in God's good creation. And we need a way, as this passage addresses, to make peace. We need a way of making peace with God. Now, if you are here as a visitor this evening, or you're watching on the live stream, maybe you've been invited by a friend, or you've been investigating the Christian faith, you've come along this evening, as it were, because you want to walk around the Christian car and kind of kick the tires a bit and figuring things out. Maybe you're sitting there thinking, "Andy, come on, okay, I was with you at this point, but a war with God, I mean, that's a bit dramatic, isn't it? That language is a bit strong." Well, my answer to you would be, not really. Not really. I would argue that the whole history, the whole story of human history, is the story of that war, is the story of humanity wanting independence from God. We want our freedom. We want to be in charge. We want to be the center of the universe. We want to be rid of God and put God in his place. I point this out to my atheist friends all the time. They want to be rid of God, yes, but they don't want nothing in the place. They want themselves to be in the place and the center of the universe. Like the pettiest of petty tyrants, we want the power, we want the authority, we want the freedom, and we want to be in charge. Rather like Gollum in Tolkien's Lord of the Rings. You know, we scream at God, my freedom, it's mine, I want it, my precious. And if you know your Tolkien, of course, you know you're talking, you will know that lust for power, that desire to be God in God's place, will destroy us, just like the ring, Gollum's precious in Lord of the Rings, betrayed him and destroyed him at the crack of doom. Little bit of Tolkien for you. "Precious, precious, precious," Gollum cried. "My precious, my precious." And with that, even as his eyes were lifted up to gloat on his prize, he stepped too far. He toppled. He wavered for a moment, and then with a shriek, he fell. Out of the depths came his last wail, "Precious!" and he was gone. And Tolkien, who was a profoundly Christian writer, I think would say that that is us. And the Bible would say that is us. That is humanity. We have that desire to be God in God's place. We want to grab that power. We want to be rulers of our own destiny. And that desire lies at the heart of every war. It lies at the heart of every injustice. It lies at the heart of every evil thought, every wicked grab for power, every broken promise, every damaged or wrecked relationship. We are radical individualists as humans who think we can run the world and do a better job of it than God can, despite every bit of evidence to the contrary. That is the default human position. And as Romans chapter 5, verse 6 points out, the thing is, we can't fix this. We cannot fix this. We are powerless to make peace with God on our own terms. And this is deeply humbling, actually, because if you're like me, you'll be tempted to think things like, well, I can fix this. That, again, is the default human response to this. You know, I can sort it out. If there is a God, and if things are sort of bad between us, and I'm at odds with him, maybe I can work hard, and I can improve, and I can do things better, and I can sort it out. And notice where the emphasis is in all of that. I. Again, it comes back to me. But the Bible tells us very, very honestly and very directly, no, you can't. You are powerless. You can't do it. But God can. God can. And he has, and he's taken the initiative. Look at verse 8 of Romans chapter 5, and let the wonder of that sink in. God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. See, the Bible tells us that Jesus Christ, God in the flesh, he has taken our rebellion. He's taken our self-centeredness. He's taken our greed and our selfishness and our apathy. He's taken that into himself. He has borne the punishment for us, paid the penalty of death for it, and he has done all of that in order to make peace. Jesus has done all of that to bring peace between us and God. In our default state as human beings, we are at war with God. It's a war of our own making. But it turns out that God, even though we have turned ourselves into his enemy, has nevertheless loved us and radically, shockingly, recklessly, wonderfully, astonishingly has taken the initiative of making peace with us. See, we live in this age of self-help, where we like to think that if we apply the right program, if we read the right book, if we watch the right YouTube video, we can figure out how to fix things. But it turns out, after all, that we don't need self-help. We don't need self-help. We need salvation. We don't need advice or a motivational talk, but we need rescue. And rescue and salvation are exactly what Jesus has done for us. And the result of that, if you accept the offer of what God has done for you in Jesus, if you lay down your rebel's arms and surrender, then the result is peace. But so much more than peace, because there also with that comes forgiveness and love and joy and welcome, acceptance and hope, and the ability to say, as we sung in that hymn, it is well with my soul. See, we live, my friends, in a world in which there is war and darkness and injustice and pain, but we also live in a world where there is hope to be found, because the root cause of all of that mess, war with God, can be healed through the forgiveness and the peace that God offers to us. For it's forgiveness that we ultimately need to bring an end to war and bring peace in its place. Speaking of forgiveness, as we draw this to a close, I earlier mentioned and quoted from Corrie ten Boom, one of my spiritual heroes. Some of you here may know her story, some of you may not. It's quite an incredible testimony, Corrie's life. She, in 1939, Corrie was living with her father and her sister in the Netherlands, where her dad ran a watchmaker's shop. And if you know your history, in 1940, Holland fell to the Nazis, and soon attacks on Jews became commonplace. Well, Corrie and her dad and her sister were committed Christians, and so they began hiding Jewish people in their house and then smuggling them out of the country to safety. And over sort of the 3 or 4 years they did that, they rescued hundreds of people. But in 1944, disaster struck. The authorities discovered what they were doing. They were arrested by the German Gestapo. Her father died very quickly after arrest, but Corrie and her sister Betsy were tossed into the notorious Ravensbrück concentration camp, a concentration camp the Nazis had built for women prisoners. There they suffered horrific abuse and atrocities, and her sister Betsy eventually died an agonizing death. Corrie, however, survived and was eventually released and began a post-war career as an evangelist, traveling across Europe and preaching about God's love and forgiveness like I've done tonight. But then one day, something incredibly shocking happened. Let me read to you a few paragraphs from her autobiography. She writes, it was at a church service in Munich that I saw him, the former SS man who had stood guard at the shower room door in the processing center at Ravensbrück. He was the first of our actual jailers that I'd seen since that time. And suddenly it was all there. The room full of mocking men, the heaps of clothing, Betsy's pain-blanched face. He came up to me as the church was emptying, beaming, and bowing. "How grateful I am for your message, Fräulein," he said, "to think that as you say, as you preached, Jesus has washed my sins away." His hands was held out, thrust out to shake mine. I tried to smile. I struggled to raise my hand. I could not. I felt nothing, not the slightest spark of warmth or charity. And so again, I breathed a silent prayer. "Jesus, I cannot forgive him. Grant me, give me your forgiveness." As I took his hand, the most incredible thing happened. From my shoulder and along my arm, and threw into my hand, a current seemed to pass from me to him, while into my heart sprang a love for this stranger that almost overwhelmed me. And so I discovered that it is not on our forgiveness any more than on our goodness that the world's healing hinges, but on Christ's. To which I can only say, I completely and utterly agree with her. Let's pray, and then we will sing a closing hymn together. Father God, we live in difficult, challenging times. It can be tempting to doom scroll our way through the news, feeling more and more depressed. But thank you that there is hope to be found in the gospel. But thank you too for the honesty with which Scripture addresses our condition. That unless we address that war, that state of war that we're in with you, then never will the problems of our world be put right. Lord, for those of us here who have had that experience of being put right with you, who have placed our trust in you, would you give us just a greater and richer and deeper sense of how amazing it is? Forgive us, perhaps we take it for granted because we've heard this kind of stuff so often. Give us just that fresh revelation of what the power of Romans 5:8 means, that even while we were your enemies, Christ died for us. And Lord, give us just an overwhelming desire to share that news with others. But Lord, for those here this evening or watching on the live stream who have not experienced that joy and that wonder of reconciliation with you through Jesus, Lord, as they reflect on these big questions we've thought about tonight, and especially that lack of hope that exists outside of the Christian faith, would they just hear that still small voice of your Spirit drawing them to you and to Christ? And would you challenge them to just lay down their arms, wave that flag of surrender, and say, "You are Lord, and they are not." And would even tonight there'll be people making that step of faith, becoming members of your family this evening. Lord, we look at some of the big issues in our age and wonder what can be done. But thank you that the much, much bigger story of what you have done for us and the fact that love ultimately will win, and we know that because of the cross, is the bigger story of all. Give us confidence and hope as people who follow you, even in these difficult times. And we ask all of that in the name of the peacemaker who gave his life for us, Jesus Christ.